Here we continue this week's Book of the Week, The Last Asylum by the historian and academic Barbara Taylor. Having embarked on an analysis with a man she called V, Barbara began to find the process all-consuming. As her work fell away and she talked of nothing else, a friend gave her a hardback notebook with the suggestion that she might like to write some of her thoughts down. The reader is Maggie Steed.
At first, the writing was difficult, but soon the words came easily. I didn't tell V about it for nearly a year.
You were afraid I would ask to read it?
No, it just didn't seem important.
And what if I asked to read it?
You wouldn't.
Are you sure? I would probably learn a lot from it. You're a historian, after all.
What's history got to do with it?
I hear the silliness of this even as I say it.
Everything.
Before I went into analysis, I knew nothing of me. I lugged myself around like an incubus, an alien eye thing that had been foisted upon me. All I knew about this so-called self was that she was wrong and bad. Now I would find out why.
We lived in a small city on the Canadian prairies. Dad had fought with the International Brigade in the Spanish Civil War.
"Your father," Mum would say to me, "was a real leader." I grew up on endless stories about this and later displays of Dad's left-wing courage. Over time, I came to understand that Mum also is a brave freedom fighter. In 1960, she became a magistrate, later a judge. She was also a prison reformer, peace campaigner, and a passionate supporter of the civil rights movement. I am a child of history in the heroic register. I am a daughter of the greatest parents ever. I am the luckiest girl in the world. My reverence for them occasionally lifted a friend's eyebrow, but I paid no heed. Nor did the gulf between their political values and their personal behaviour disconcert me in the slightest. Dad was a domestic tyrant of the old school, Mum, his adoring slave. To Dad and Mum, being important meant living beyond oneself, in the admiration of others. To be unimportant, to be ordinary, Mum would spit the word out like a curse, was a living death. I must become a successful person. To become properly successful, I must write books. To be a celebrated writer was the imperative. 12 months after beginning psychoanalysis, I published Eve and the New Jerusalem, a reworking of my doctoral thesis on feminism and utopian socialism. The book was widely and rapturously reviewed, and I was awarded the Isaac Deutscher Memorial Prize, the first woman to win it. I had no expectation of such success, and was stunned by it. My parents flew over from Canada for the celebration party.
"It's a terrific book,"
a friend said to Mum.
"Yes, I'm sure,"
Mum said, adjusting the strap on my dress.
"Her father and I are hoping the next one will be a novel." How had I become bad? Like birth, like breath, it was a condition of life. I was bad, the way God is good.
"That's just Barb," Mum would say, and I would hear her resigned disgust. Occasionally she would add that I was selfish or pushy. And I was very greedy. This I was told repeatedly. All of her criticisms of me, without exception, were accusations she made against herself. I was merely an extrusion from her. I was she, and she wanted to love me and could not. She was me, and I loved her to death. Dad was our lover man. Mum liked to tell a story about taking me on a car journey when I was 4. I insisted on sitting on the front seat next to Dad.
I'm Mummy now, I announced.
Such an ordinary story.
She thought it was funny, and maybe for most children it would be. But I was Mummy.
And as I got older, the war over Daddy became a nightmare of envy and hate. My sister Lisa was born 2 years after me.
Soon after Lisa's birth, Mum suffered what she later described as the miseries. In fact, it seems likely that she had a full-blown breakdown. When Mum consulted her doctor, he instructed her to focus on the joys of motherhood. I'm sure Mum tried, but it didn't work.
So she signed up for law school and handed over Lisa and me to a young woman hired for the purpose.
Our first housekeeper was Rose, recruited from a local home for unwed mothers. Rose arrived with a big tummy and departed briefly a few months later, returning flat-bellied. She remained with us for another 2 years before leaving to get married. Mum turned again to the charity home, and a string of pregnant women followed. One after another, these girls would arrive, stay for a while, go off for a few days, return, sans belly, sans baby. Few of them, Mum complained, knew how to cook, and many were low-spirited. Eventually, Mum began hiring through the local press, mostly farm girls, as before, but ones unburdened by illicit pregnancies. It seems never to have occurred to Mum that the low spirits displayed by these girls might be grief. Why should it, when such things were never discussed? Why not give a girl who has lost her child responsibility for your own little ones? She was doing the girls a favor, Mum thought, and no one would have disagreed. But what happened to the babies? Now there was a puzzle for a little girl. I knew that there should be babies, because Mum too had grown a big belly, which eventually produced Lisa. But no one said anything about these girls' babies. So what had become of them? Had the babies died? And if so, who had killed them? After I had been in analysis for a time, I started having dream after dream about dead babies, often in the guise of chickens or other small, consumable animals. One morning in a session, I suddenly recalled Mum reading Hansel and Gretel to me when I was about 5. I loved fairy tales and sat snuggled up next to her, tingling with anticipation. As the story progressed, I began to feel anxious, then very frightened. When she reached the bit about the child-eating witch, I howled and struck the book from her hands. In 1971, I arrived in London in a flat panic. What am I doing here? How am I going to survive? And grabbed the first man in sight. We had nothing in common except self-dislike, but I stuck with him for a year or so. Others followed, but there was only one man worth having, and that was Dad. To imagine otherwise was impossible. Mum visited me in London when I was 22 and took me to lunch at Harrods. I had been in the city for 6 months and was proud of my metropolitan mouse. I had a flat. I could find my way around on the tube, and I had 2 lovers, the height of sophistication. Now, over our avocado salads, Mum told me about her lovers. Your dad had girlfriends, so I thought, why shouldn't I have boyfriends? She wouldn't tell me the names of these men, or of Dad's girlfriends, and I didn't try to guess them. Mum's boyfriends, I later concluded, were fewer than she implied. She didn't want me to think I was getting ahead of her, and acquired mostly in revenge for Dad's affairs. It took 8 years of psychoanalysis before I could remember that Dad had flirted with waitresses, a memory that surfaced on a tide of misery and fear so intense that it almost pushed me out of the analysis.
By contrast, I remembered well how Dad had liked to fondle me, pulling me down beside him on the sofa to caress me from neck to knee. He did this until I left home at 21. But this memory, even as I recount it to V, seems ordinary, inconsequential. In 1982, shortly after I began analysis, I moved with my partner and another couple into a big, handsome house in Highbury. So much for left-wing austerity. My partner was intelligent and energetic, and for nearly a decade we had got on well enough. But he was never going to be the real deal. Mum had bagged the only truly desirable man. However, with mental breakdown and the advent of V, matters took on a different hue. With V as my clay-footed idol, I was free to seek lesser heroes. And I did. For 3 feverish years, I dashed from one affair to another, dreaming about wife murder, mother murder. I made women furious with me, including some of my friends who found my behavior astonishing. I was as surprised as they. I had no idea where this Jezebel had come from. I drink heavily, take fistfuls of pills, rail at V, whose stolidity in the face of my suffering makes me nauseous with rage. I have more sexual encounters, all of which travel the same emotional path from dizzy excitement and triumph, another one, look at me, Mum, to a sick misery that even without V pointing it out to me, I now realize has little to do with the men involved. Almost any man, it seems, will produce this suffering, so long as he eventually rejects me. I am overwhelmed by feelings of abandonment. My world is a blank desert. I cannot survive in it. I can see that it is no accident that my first affair began within days of my first analytic session. And I can easily perceive how Dad and V have merged into my romantic ideal, which I pursue fruitlessly. So I am not surprised, I tell myself, by what I am going through, although I am disturbed by the intensity of it. What does surprise and upset me very much, however, is the ferocity of my hatred for V, alongside the love and yearning. I follow strict emotional rules, and hate is not permissible. But hate, I am now discovering, is the breath and bone of me. The exhaustion that crushes me, the aching tension locking my muscles, the tightness in my throat and the weight in my chest. My hatreds are turning me into stone. I dream of slashed bellies, decapitations, mutilated babies. Lying on the couch, I quote a line from a case history of Donald Winnicott. It is best, in this stage of the analysis, if the analysand does not carry a gun.
Maggie Steed was reading from The Last Asylum by Barbara Taylor. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. Well, what's next if you've been affected by the floods? On Call You and Yours at midday today, environment and insurance experts will answer your questions. The number to call from 11 03700 100 444.
Mrs. Long says that Netherfield is taken by a young man of large fortune from the north of England.
What is his name?
Mr. Bingley.
One of the nation's favourite novels.
A single man of large fortune, 4,000 or 5,000 a year. What a fine thing for one of our girls.
Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice.
You would not believe the shocking rudeness of his friend, Mr. Darcy. But I can assure you that Lizzie does not lose much by not suiting his fancy, for he is a most disagreeable, horrid man.
BBC Radio 4's new classic serial, starting on Sunday afternoon at 3:00.